The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. It is just after 9 o'clock on Monday, the 23rd of February, 2026. It's great to have you on board. How was your weekend? I hope it was really good. If you're into sport, it was a fantastic weekend with the rugby. We had boxing, if you're into boxing. The Olympics were finishing up. The SPL's getting very interesting. Scotland and Rangers both losing ground. What else happened? Donegal, of course, the men's seniors had a fantastic win, 4 in a row. Lots and lots of sport, it has to be said. What was your standout sporting moment of the weekend? Or let us know what you want to talk about as well. Maybe something happened to you over the weekend that you want to share. Maybe an act of kindness. Maybe an issue that you think we could help you with. Anything at all. The lines are open for you right now. 086 60 25 000. That's the WhatsApp and text number. 086 60 25 000. We love your calls still, even in 2026. You can't beat an old conversation over the phone. 074 91 25 000. Caroline Orr, our researcher and producer, on the lines, assisted by ably Shannon Wilkins, and of course emails, comments at highlandradio.com. if you want to watch the program as well, and you can chat to us there. You can go onto YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch us live on your mobile devices, or indeed your smart TV and Fire Stick, and we're across Facebook as well. So literally no excuse not to have some of the show some way or other. Let's have a quick look at what's making the papers today. And I have to say, right across the nationals, a lot of the same news. You know, I notice a lot of the tabloids now, the red top tabloids, they're all the same paper. Not a whole pile of variation in the news. But anyway, we've picked out some stories that may be of interest to you. The Derry People, Donegal News this morning. The chair of the newly established Donegal Local Community Safety Partnership says outside agencies, community groups and local organisations all have a part to play in helping to make people's lives safer across Donegal. The Donegal LSCSP, which has replaced the old Joint Policing Committee, will hold its first proper meeting at County House Lifford on Wednesday, and chairperson Councillor Jay McMonagall said he's looking forward to finally getting a chance to discuss and address the many issues that need tackling. The Derry News, their front page focuses really on a picture, and it is asking the question, dispute over restoration of Free Derry Wall, and there's a picture of that wall present on the front of that paper as well. On to the Nationals. Interesting analysis of people's experiences whilst doing their driving test. This is in the Irish Independent. A driving instructor spent an entire lesson watching a movie on his phone while another teacher tailgated a car, flashed the vehicle's lights and gestured at another motorist, according to complaints to the Road Safety Authority. The RSA said it had been contacted by more than 160 unhappy learner drivers last year about the quality of driving lessons and instruction. Sorry, I did say testing, I meant lessons. One person accused their instructor of using a racial slur, making sexualized comments and joking about women's aid for battering his car. The complaint claimed the teacher had said, "Watch that hand or I'll have a case against you," implying that I had nearly touched him inappropriately, which I absolutely had not. Another learner wrote of receiving threatening text messages from an instructor who said they were going to report them for driving without insurance. They added, "A girl has also come out to me saying he would be talking about other girls during driving lessons, talking about private body parts with his clients. Completely unacceptable." It's a very personal space, that, in a car with a stranger. The one thing I will say, though, these surveys come out annually in relation to people getting lessons and stuff. But I've never really heard these stories from a real person or in person. So, I mean, maybe you've got a story. It doesn't have to be very serious. It can be lighthearted either. Maybe you've got a story in relation to your lessons or your test. Share it with us this Monday morning. 086 60 25 000. A lot of money gets spent on the president and its office. €570,000 is going to be spent on merchandise. I can't even get a mug here or a T-shirt to give away. But anyway, that being said, I probably haven't asked. The government is proposing to spend almost €600,000 on tote bags, stationery and other merchandise to promote Ireland's EU presidency. This is the presidency, not the president. Again, sorry, my mistake. Arnold is due to take over the rotating presidency in July and will hold it for 6 months. As part of preparations, the Department of Foreign Affairs is ordering large consignments of branded merchandise for free distribution. Most of the stationery packs will be delivered to Dublin, but many will be distributed to 99 cities around the world. For example, the department is proposing to send 100 each to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and to Maputo, Mozambique, and 200 to the Vatican. Ireland's permanent mission in Brussels to the EU will receive €11,000, while the emphasis on Washington, D.C., or the embassy, sorry, will get 400. So these are €570,000 on EU presidency merchandise. Right, so who's buying up all the houses? It's not necessarily people from within the state, because the vast bulk of investment in property is now from abroad. This is in the Irish Daily Mail. Foreign finance made up to 70% of Irish property investment last year, a new report shows. Investment turnover totaled almost $2.5 billion last year, a similar level to the 2024. Property agent Sherry Fitzgerald's latest Irish investment market report has found the total number of transactions stood at 125, just ahead of the 119 recorded in 24. As is traditionally the case, the final 3 months of the year were the most active, with investment reaching 842 million. Shops and shopping centres attracted the largest share of turnover in 2025, making up more than a quarter, 28% of total market spend. However, the gap with other asset classes narrowed, with offices accounting for 27% of turnover. The second half of last year also witnessed renewed interest in residential properties, making up 16% of turnover, while industrial and logistic assets accounted for a further 10%. So I don't know what this actually means. Maybe this is the norm in every country, but in terms of, you know, the infrastructure, shopping centres, etc., and indeed property to some extent, the vast bulk of investment in these areas comes from abroad. So I don't know. A lot of conversation, and I don't wish to bore you, about whether or not under 16s should be banned from mobile phones. I think it is worth talking about and highlighting the various sort of marks in the story, because, as I say, this isn't necessarily about it is, of course, about banning under 16s from mobile phones, but the way you do that, it's everybody has to sort of identify themselves before going on the internet. That's just the byproduct of it, because you can only prove someone's age by checking everybody's age. But what do students think? And this is what I thought was an interesting advance on this story, because it's the views of children. Half of senior cycle secondary school students would support introducing a social media ban for under 16s, a new survey has found. The government recently announced plans to introduce legislation restricting access for under 16s as part of its new digital and artificial intelligence strategy. The move comes following increasing interest in social media age limits from governments in France and Spain. The poll of almost 1,800 fourth, fifth and sixth year students from online study tool StudyClix found that 50% would back moves by Ireland to follow the Australian government's example in passing legislation to prevent people under the age of 16 from accessing major social media services like Instagram, X, TikTok and Facebook. So the majority of these, if this is fourth, fifth and sixth class, would the majority of them be over 16 already? But half of the total, about 900, are in favour of the ban. So half aren't. I think that it's not quite what you might call students backing it. Personally, I don't think it is anyway. Because you're not really asking either the cohort that it affects. Some would be caught in it, but anyway. A very important story to finish, and that is how dangerous the roads were over the weekend. An awful loss of life. 7 people passed away or were killed on roads, a further 6 injured. 7 people lost their lives, while 6 people were injured in separate collisions on Irish roads at the weekend. 4 fatal collisions across the country on Saturday claimed the lives of 3 women, 3 men and a teenaged girl, while 6 others, including a child, were treated for injuries. On Saturday, a man and a woman, both aged in their 40s, lost their lives following a collision involving a van and a car at around midday in Tramore in Waterford. The occupants of the car were pronounced dead at the scene, while the occupants of the van, a man aged in his 50s and a juvenile male, were taken to University Hospital Waterford for treatment of injuries believed to be non-life-threatening. A woman in her 80s also died following a single vehicle collision in Galway. That was at around 8:15 p.m. on Saturday. Her body was brought to the mortuary at Portumlinca Hospital, where a post-mortem will take place. A 16-year-old girl, just 16 years of age, she was killed in a hit-and-run incident on the Slane Road near Navan. The girl, a pedestrian, was struck by a car. We also had injuries to a man in a collision last evening at Umbercombe, which wouldn't be included in these statistics. Hopefully his injuries are not life-threatening and he'll make a full and speedy recovery. But can you imagine, like, seven, in this tiny wee country of ours, seven people killed, and the heartache that's bringing into Irish households in the days, weeks, months and years ahead. And I'm not attributing any blame to anyone, because I don't know the circumstances of the road traffic collisions, but a lot of this is avoidable. It's within our powers. And seven people in this tiny wee country dying in one weekend is just absolutely heartbreaking. And I speak to myself when I say things like this. Maybe we need to, again, just redouble our efforts to think about how we're driving and what the consequences can be if we take our eye off the road for a second, have the right pedal down too much, or whatever it might be. We are joined on the programme now by local archaeologist John O'Rourke. Good morning, John.
Morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Right, I'll take the listeners back to 1811, because in December of that year, a Royal Navy frigate sank off the coast of County Donegal, and the mystery surrounding the final resting place of part of the wreck may now finally have been solved. Recent sand displacement caused by high winds at Ballymastocker Bay in Loch Swilly have revealed that some what some believe to be the remains of HMS Saldanha. Before I get your view on whether or not these are in fact the remains or the wreckage of this ship, talk to me about this Royal Naval frigate and how it may have come to perish off our coast.
So back then, Greg, the vessels that plied their trade around the coast, it was like, if you can imagine, the equivalent of articulated lorries today. There were lots of them. There were continuously small, locally owned and large ocean-going vessels in and around the coast of Inishowen. It's hard to appreciate now the level of traffic there actually was. Because of the wars that were going on in Europe at the time, the English stationed a small flotilla at Rathmullen, and they patrolled what was known to the English as the Northern Approaches. So anything really north of us on the approaches to the UK would have been interdicted by the ships based in Rathmullen. So a frigate, a large vessel, but not large on the scale of things. If you've seen the Victory, for instance, far smaller than that. The Saldanha was probably about 150 feet in length, just a little bit short of 150 feet. Still a substantial vessel with a crew of maybe 270, 275 sailors. So very, very busy location at the time. On a patrol at the start of December, the Saldanha and a smaller vessel, the Talbot, went north from Loch Swilly and encountered the start of a hurricane. And it was truly a horrendous storm. We've got lots of other reports of ships that foundered that night, and of damage being done to buildings and roofs and chimneys. It was a fairly unique storm, what the sailors would have called a true hurricane. As the Saldanha would have attempted to get to shelter, she entered Loch Swilly, and we know some of the story as to what happened. Still some mystery there.
Yeah, so, and this would be, what do you do in the case of high winds or hurricane, right? The sails, massive. So you drop the sails, or you drop some of the sails, and you try and, you know, then, of course, the ability to steer the vessel is compromised. I mean, it's the worst case scenario to be in a boat like that, isn't it, with incredibly high winds and turbulent waters. It must have been horrific to be aboard.
Absolutely horrific. So every sailor has a few things they can do in these conditions. You can go to bare poles, take down the sails, scud on front of the wind. That means you're going as slowly as possible, more or less in the same direction as the wind. You can try and veer up into the wind and actually make way at an angle into the wind and try and keep keep your position that way. Very few other things you can do when you're in something like a hurricane in a square-rigged vessel. So we're pretty sure from reports of other vessels that they had to scud on front of the wind. There wasn't much else they could have done. We have the logs of the Talbot, and the Talbot ended up the following morning in the area of Clew Bay, that far south. And we've got some great reports from the Talbot with regard to the conditions. We're pretty sure the Saldanha, wherever she was, had to scud on front of the wind. We're also reasonably confident. Now, we've got to be like journalists here. You know, these days, you've got to check again. You've got to find the primary source for everything. And about half of what you hear is completely wrong. And we've got to take exactly the same approach. We've got to look for the veracity and we've got to find primary sources. We're fairly certain she entered the lock at around 10 o'clock on the night of the 4th, coming south at a rapid pace down the lock. We're confident that she hit at the Swilly Rocks. They're the rocks on the west side of the entrance to the lock. And we have some evidence of that. We have some reports of that. And again, the reports are from fairly credible sources. So that one is a confident of, but not certain of. And then we've got other debris that's been recovered over the years. Anchors that have been recovered from the area north of Dunree, between Dunree and the Swilly Rocks. The masts and sails of the Saldanha came in at Dunree the following morning. So what's a very likely thing to have happened is that when she clipped the Swilly Rocks, she lost her rudder, she lost her rudder chains, and she was demasted or partly demasted at that point. Now, that would be a normal thing to happen if a sailing vessel of that vintage had a collision. So fairly confident up to where she clipped the Swilly Rocks, but she didn't break in two at that point. One thing the English have very, very well is historical documentation and public service records. So we can pull the logs and records from Kew Gardens in London, and we know exactly what was in the hold of the Saldanha. She didn't break in two on the Swilly Rocks. There's a very characteristic signature of the point she broke into.
Now, in relation to what has been revealed with the movement of sands, it's clearly a structure of some description or other. It's too uniform. It does offer itself to be a vessel of some description or other, and then you think of what might it be or what could it be. That's not enough, of course, to confirm this is indeed the wreck of the Royal Navy frigate. But in terms of confidence, where are you at now at this point that this actually could be the final resting place of this boat, this ship?
So we approach this stage a little bit like a forensic investigator. What is telling you it's not the wreck? What is telling you it is the wreck? So the shape, as you say, that shape looks to the eye like it's the starboard bow. And there's almost 12 metres of debris, of a structure. Now, that's about 40 feet. And the vessel itself was only 150 feet long. And we have all the original shear drawings. We have the equivalent of the build data for the Saldanha, so we know exactly how far back that section goes. So that's all quite consistent with it being part of the starboard bow. But there's other things then that are a little bit inconsistent. We, again, have got loads of records of the morning after the wreck. We know that the Saldanha was split two. She was in two separate parts with debris everywhere. The main reports we have are of the wreck being in the south of the lock. Sorry, the south of the bay. So quite far away from where this debris is shown. We don't have any records for half of the vessel ending up, or a third of the vessel ending up in the mid part of the...
But we don't know what may have happened underwater with currents either, though, at the same time as things were emptied out.
Once she sat and they began to empty her... It's unlikely something of that size moved. Now, right down at the level of the keel, there were huge heavy weights, big, big, big iron bars used for ballast and gravel used for ballast. So once she was broken to and actually sat on the beach, she was actually going to sink in situ. She was going to sink in place.
So is this kind of like trying to prove a negative then? How would it find its way to where it's been discovered then, given everything you've just said?
Absolutely no issue with that. It is completely feasible and possible that it's there. I just don't have reports that say the following morning they actually saw it at that point.
Now, we've lots
of reports from the following morning.
We've seen, we're just seeing sort of the ends of some of the structure. What's next? If you were to excavate down to expose everything that is actually lying there within the sand, I mean, what likely would we discover?
So it's the bow, and they kept the bow reasonably light. They put a lot of the ballast and a lot of the weight would have been amidships. It's 40 feet long, which means that we're into a part of the hold that would have had stuff in it. Mm. And we absolutely know what would be at the lowest levels. So let's assume it's still all intact, and let's assume that we've figured out where what we're actually seeing. We can see joints on the bit that was exposed. Those joints are called scarfs. Now, I can go back then to the original designs of the vessels, and I can tell you at exactly the height they are above the keel. So either you're looking at something that's 8 foot above the keel or 12 foot above the keel. Apologies for using imperial measurements. Everything in the old records is imperial. We'll move away from
that. I'm not going to lie to you. It suits me.
So we know that if it's the lowest joints it can possibly be we're looking at, that there's potentially 8 feet or so from there to the keel. Above the keel, there's some very characteristic things. So that iron ballast isn't random lumps of iron. It's got a particular pattern. It's got a particular shape. It'll have Admiralty markings on it, and it will have holes in exactly the right places. So if it is excavated at some point in the future, we will be able to say definitively that's an Admiralty ship, and we also know definitively that no other vessel of that size would have broken up at that point.
We're interested in it because there's history here, there's a story here, and it's local, and the way it's been revealed is really interesting. How interested are the British in relation to this? Like, is this just another vessel that may have perished during that awful weather? Like, hundreds would have, I suppose, over centuries. Is there any particular interest in this from the British? Will they be watching on? Might they be interested in some sort of an excavation?
Oh, absolutely. So we can say without contention that we have a very mixed history, but we've got to appreciate that in the Napoleonic era, about 20% of those who fought with the English were Irish. Mm-hmm. England had a much smaller population at the time, and we were a great source of warm bodies for those folks. But separate from that, everybody's heard of the Duke of Wellington, the Pakenham's Lord Longford. Captain Pakenham of the Saldanha was one of the Longfords he was Irish. We know looking at the muster, we know the people who were aboard, and a lot of those people were Irish. Not just were they Irish, some of them will have volunteered for, you know, it was a very, very poor country and it was one way out of poverty, although it was a horrendous existence, but people were also pressed or impressed. That means a bunch of sailors would go down to the local pub with cudgels, knock people over the head, drag them back to the boat legally, and they were impressed into the Navy. So a lot of those people weren't volunteers. Some of them were lifted out of fishing boats. One of these vessels could pull up alongside your fishing boat, lift you out of it, your family never saw you again. So there's a huge mixture of cultures here. The English are absolutely fascinated by their military history and have absolutely no doubt that we will see interest from the UK. If you want to see what the Saldanha looked like, there's a very well-restored vessel sitting in Hartlepool Harbour. So a quick flight into Newcastle, an hour's drive south, and there's a beautifully restored vessel called the Trincomalee sitting in Hartlepool. And honestly, unless you're an expert on the individual vessels, you wouldn't be able to distinguish between that and the Saldanha.
A caller says, I heard a story that some years ago when there was a particularly low tide, the rudder of the ship was found lodged in a rock at the mouth of Loch Swilly, probably still there. I'm not sure if there's... Have you heard that story before?
So I've heard exactly that story, and that's consistent with everything else we know. Okay. So I have that from the 1970s in my lists, but unfortunately it's anecdotal. I don't have the original.
I think this might be the anecdote we're leaning on here. Is this the same ship that a load of gold was supposed to be found on?
So, Greg, you have me on video.
Yes.
But the listeners won't have. Can you see my wedding
ring? I can, yes.
Can you?
Yes. No, I can't see a wedding ring. Of course,
you can't.
No, yeah.
So that's the only way I can say with confidence that there's gold on the wreck of the Saldanha.
Okay. And
so during a long dive many, many years ago,
that's where you lost.
With freezing cold hands, the ring came off. So a message to future archaeologists, if you find the ring, please return it. My wife would appreciate it.
And in terms of finding out more information, is sand too dense for any sort of ground-penetrating technology? This would require an excavation. And what would be the next step in that regard?
So we're very, very careful to be non-invasive. And it's more than just idealism. As time goes by, technology improves. And something that will destroy an artefact today, we can do non-invasively in 20 years' time. So you'll find archaeologists being incredibly conservative. There are techniques we can use right now. So we know there's iron down there, and a magnetometer will let us see iron at that sort of depth and allow us to calculate depth and volume or mass of iron. There's ground-penetrating radar that we would use on land a lot. Now, I'm not confident that will work in that wet environment. And we know there's also a lot of iron material.
It's just
in
the density
soil
of the sand as well, too, I'd imagine. It's complicated.
Density isn't so much. For ground-penetrating radar, I could take something that looks like a wheelbarrow outside your house, and I could map all your pipes and the electricity feeds coming in. So density is not so much a problem. It's the wet environment that gives us some issues. There's another device called a sub-bottom profiler where we put low-frequency sound waves down through the actual surface of the sand, and that's absolutely magic. But again, we need a certain depth to use that. We need the depth of water. And that particular bay, when you've got a high tide, 4 metres of tide, you'll have rolling waves coming in there.
Of course,
it's a really challenging environment to work with. So there are a range of instruments we can use.
Okay.
We have to be non-invasive.
Yeah, but so you've got patience. So in other words, I'm impatient. So like, I'm not going to get an answer anytime soon. You're just sitting there going, it could take 30 years. And I so much admire it, John. But for me, like, I was hoping, like, do we start tomorrow?
What I can tell you is that even the part of the wreck that was just still exposed is actually disintegrating.
Yeah.
So if we excavate, it's a one-go job.
Exactly.
We will destroy absolutely everything that's there, and that the opportunity to study it further in the future is gone. Now, the competent authority is the Monument Service, and they are going to come back down again in March, and they are the folks with resources and top-end skills that will allow them to investigate further without destroying the wreck. We can work locally with our own resources, privately, but honestly, we are constrained. Like thousands of other people in Donegal, I have defective blocks. And at my age, I'm facing either with things get sorted or I'm homeless, which is something that I never expected in my 60s. So unfortunately, putting large resources into this is beyond me at this stage.
Well, listen, I wish you the very best in navigating that process. It is not easy. Local archaeologist John O'Rourke, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Greg.
Joined on the programme now by Jason Quinn. Jason, thanks for chatting to me this morning.
Okay, yeah.
Right, now, you're refusing dialysis treatment at Letterkenny University Hospital. Why?
I've been on dialysis for about 2 years now. And the way they do dialysis is through a tube in my chest, a permanent tube in my chest. Now, that's susceptible to infection and problems. And especially last year, I had a lot of problems with the tube and gone into a kind of shock where I'd go into involuntary shakes, difficulty with breathing and low blood pressure. This is while on dialysis, and this is problems with the tube. And one of the things that can help with this is to have what's called a fistula, which means tying of an artery and a vein, like in the arm, where they would put needles directly into the arm and do the dialysis that way. And you're not you're not susceptible to infection as much, and it gives you a better dialysis. I've been on the waiting list for over a year. And middle of last year, I was told I was about seventh on the waiting list. But unfortunately, I had an infection in my leg, and my foot, and I had to have my small toe and part of my foot removed because of it. So that slowed my time on the waiting list. Last October, I was told I was going back on the list again because the injury on the other that was left by the wound was clean and infection free. Just before December, I rang up Galway trying to find out what was happening, and I was informed that the consultant down there only does one of these procedures once a month.
So just for the uninitiated, Jason, you are refusing dialysis treatment through your chest. You want it to be delivered through an arm. Is that correct? Just in the most simple terms?
Yes.
And when you say you're waiting, are you waiting to be seen by a consultant who can refer you for that type of treatment, or are you waiting to begin that treatment and you were seventh on the list? So what are you actually waiting on?
I'm waiting for the. I've had the scans. I've had all the referrals done. This was done last February last year, and I've been waiting on the list for over a year. Mm. But I was actually told last week by the manager in the renal unit at Letterkenny that the consultant in Galway only meets with his team about these procedures once a month on the first Monday of each month. Mm-hmm. Now, in January, it wasn't going to happen. February was a bank holiday. I don't know what's happening about March, but April, May, June are all bank holidays, and they're not going to be meeting. Okay. So I've been told the first time they're going to be meeting is in July.
And is this with a view to getting something inserted in your arm that receives the dialysis then? I just want to really make sure I understand what you're waiting on.
What it is they link up an artery and a vein.
Okay.
In my arm. Uh-huh. And then when that heals, they can put needles directly into my arm to do the dialysis rather than taking the feed from the tube.
And when that is done, you can get your dialysis treatment to Letterkenny University Hospital.
Well, I get it done there anyway, but it makes the dialysis easier.
Understood. Yeah.
And less of risks of things going wrong.
Yeah, I just want to get... So, in other words, you're waiting to see a consultant to get this operation, to have this line put into your arm, so then you can continue receiving dialysis in Letterkenny University Hospital in that way, as opposed to through your chest, because the that way is your preference. Right, so what is the impact on you refusing dialysis treatment in the way that you don't want it delivered to you? What's the impact on your body and your health? Because you've already got an infection to the point where you've had to have part of your foot amputated.
Well, if I refusing dialysis means fluid just builds up in my body, and it just stores it and stores it until your body just will slow down, and it'll impact other parts like your breathing and your mobility and stuff. But the thing is, I'm waiting and waiting. Galway will not give you a clear, definitive answer of what's happening. You're getting pushed aside all the time. Mm. I'm not getting any answers. So what I'm looking from Galway is I want a specific date of when this is happening, not just being pushed along with no information.
Is your resistance to dialysis now something then of a protest? Because, whilst I understand that you don't want to do it through the chest, there's a fear of infection. But you also, there is a point where, as a medical professional, you have to balance potentially the long-term impacts on your health in not doing so. So you're prepared to risk your body deteriorating to avoid infection from getting dialysis through your chest. Does that make sense medically?
It does make sense to other people, but for me, the whole situation, I've encountered many problems in the renal unit through the consultants at Letterkenny Hospital, and it's impacted on my mental health.
I do understand.
Last year I had to go on antidepressants, mm-hmm. which actually made me even worse. I was collapsing after dialysis and injuring myself.
Yes.
And I've got to the point where I have no quality of life.
And I'm really, really sorry to hear that. But are there competing issues here for you, Jason, in that you've made a mental decision not to continue with dialysis, really, and not a physical decision, if that makes sense, that you've associated negativity and negative thoughts and the fear of infection to the point whereby it's detrimental to you, you know, that you are almost saying, right, well, the only solution to all of this is to see this consultant and go away and to get my dialysis a different way. Would you not be better to, as best you can, look after your physical health now until such time as this intervention takes place? Because I understand and I'm incredibly sympathetic, Jason, but dialysis is life-saving treatment, and to refuse that over the risk of infection, albeit that you've got, you know, an awful lot of emotional connection to it as well, it might not be in your best interest. That's all I'm suggesting, if you don't mind me saying so, Jason.
No, that's understandable. And but what I, by not going in, I is my only way of making a point, because you say to people and you try and speak to the consultants and try and put your point across, they just don't listen.
Yeah,
and there's been several times when things go wrong when they haven't listened, and my quality of life is deteriorating.
I hope you have
nowhere else to go.
I understand that, and trust me, I'm so sympathetic to you. But I just hope that you aren't doing yourself damage in the process, because ethically, really, you know, from a doctor's perspective, they would have to bump someone down to bump you up, and I'm not sure they'll do that. And I just hope that the protest, if you could put it to you like that, that you're taking is actually the only person that this is impacting is yourself, Jason. And you've been through enough, and you're going through enough, and I just hope that you're not doing yourself a disservice. Whilst I fully get that you feel like you're at the end of your tether in this process,
it's not a case of wanting to jump the queue. I was told last year I was seventh in the waiting list, and now, although things went a bit pear shaped last year, I still have not been given any specifics about what's happening. There's no actual, this is happening here, this is happening there. I rung up Galway last Thursday, mm-hmm. and told them the situation, and the person on the phone said, thank you very much, and hung the phone up on me, and that was it. They just don't want to listen. They don't want to tell you any details.
Well, what we can Jason, what we can do is try and inquire as to the future appointments, and what the situation is there. I don't understand why appointments don't take place because it's a bank holiday. Surely they'd be rescheduled to Tuesday. I mean, if you schedule appointments or meetings on Mondays, you're going to miss them automatically. It's a strange bit of scheduling. So we'll have to check into that. But as I say, Jason, I do fully sympathise with you. I do understand exactly where you're coming from. But I also think that you can continue this battle, but also get your treatment. You don't want anything else to have to be cut off, you know. But listen, you're your own man, and you have to make your own decisions. But leave it with us, and we'll be in touch with you off air, okay?
Yeah, and can I just say one more thing, Greg, please? Yeah, I just want to say about the nurses in the renal unit at Letterkenny. The nurses in that unit are 100%, and they're an absolutely fantastic crowd. And I just want to mention that the excellent work that they do in there.
And they wouldn't do anything purposely to harm you, and maybe you can trust that relationship.
Oh, no. They They try and talk me out of doing stuff like this.
My advice to you is, Jason, as someone who's sort of dealt with a lot of this stuff, various campaigns, people trying to get, is that you can achieve this and get your treatment. Not taking your treatment is probably not going to advance your cause in any way, shape, or form. And I say that with love, you know. It's probably going to happen. So if I were you, I would keep the battle up. We can make our inquiries. I would go and get your treatment and give you and try and get some solace in that, Jason, and some strength actually for the battle by trying to control what you're going through. And as I say, I mean that with love and respect, Jason. But leave it with us. We'll be back in touch with you if we find anything out. The DL Debate is on air for you tonight, just after 7 p.m. and available for you whenever you wish via the podcast system. Let us say good morning to its presenter, Brendan Devenny. Hi, Brendan. Good to see you.
Good to see you, lad.
Right, OK. Busy, busy weekend in the world of sport, not least on the GEA pitches. We'll start with the senior men's because that was the game that was on yesterday. 4 out of 4, weathered storm, showed resilience, plenty of talent in that squad. Might end up winning the first division even if they don't want to.
Yeah. Listen, Greg, if we were in any other province, you would say just go for it at this point. Not to say that we won't yet. Yeah. Who are we to judge Jim? Listen, momentum is a big thing. How do you marry that with Ulster Championship is the problem in terms of tough games and that. And you think, okay, go and win it. Go and win Ulster. Then you're in the All-Ireland series and then the big crunch knockout game. So it's a matter just of managing the season and keeping everybody fresh. But at the minute, I mean, after the McKenna Cup, the brilliance that we've seen there, you know, it's top class. I mean, Jason McGee, the form he's in returning, and, you know, 4 points from him and Lang and 8 points from midfield. You know, these guys are big, talented ball winners, but they're serious lads to finish as well. And Owen Band being back too, fit, Greg, you know, not a lot of people talking about him, but his... And the new rules, the way he breaks forward, he's such a brilliant ball carrier that before he would have ran into, you know, a bit of a blanket defence at the other side. Now he's running into massive gaps. So he's so good on the ball coming out from defence. So he's another key man in there, back fit, Lamy Jason, which has been a huge difference to us this year.
Options are fantastic if you're a manager. Now, you create those options yourself, don't you? But there's a lot of different ways that this team can play.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, I think just if you look at it on the ball, you know, we are so good. There's so many people breaking the lines coming up the pitch that literally everybody is contributing. Like, McCall tends to be the only person who really stands and minds the house. Everybody else is breaking up the pitch and everybody's scoring. So in terms of an opposition defence trying to hold that, that's nearly impossible. It is impossible. And when you look then, as I say, with the aerial ability out there, you know, I think previous years, you know, if... Like I said, Jason was in there and Langan, maybe Hugh wouldn't play. Now Jim like prefers to play as many big men out there because that midfield battle is key. If we won that, if we get even a 50-50 of that, we're going to we've too many line breakers, too many people can pop the ball over the bar in the back of the net. There's Conor O'Donnell that backing up his goal the previous week against Mayo, which was vital score.
Yeah, what are you looking across the other games that took place over the weekend? I mean, you can't watch them all, right? But I mean, any stories pop out for you sort of outside of Ulster?
Yeah, well, everybody else is moving. There seems to be not hitting form. Yeah. Obviously, Armagh now are in the relegation battle. Dublin are playing poorly. You know, everything again for us is probably pointing towards Kerry. You know, Roscommon's story has been remarkable. They should have beaten Kerry in opening day and they should have been sitting on 8 with us. So, you know, when Mark O'Dowd got that job, local guy, he'd been involved in a couple of teams before. A lot of people were thinking, you know, they've just put him in to guide the team a bit. But he had other ideas and I'm hearing good stuff about him. So they've been phenomenal. 11 points down to Galway, coming back and beating their rivals there. So there's been some great stories in there. Kay McDonald's son coming on from Mayo. Kicking a couple of unbelievable scores. Of course, they're losing him.
1-4 he scored, did he?
Yeah, they're losing him.
Not a bad return.
Aussie Rules, yeah. Which is tough on Mayo. You really think, of all things they could do with a star like that. To
I feel, at this time of the season, I don't even want to talk about Mayo. I don't mean that badly, but there's been so many false dawns with them. But yeah, hey, maybe this will be the year.
Every year. It's nearly every year, isn't it?
Yeah. Camogie.
Yeah, listen, Ewan O'Donnell's joining us tonight, Camogie manager. Listen, there's been a massive break in County Camogie here in Donegal, but they've got a team together. They come in the competition, kind of got the green light to come in fairly late. They played Monaghan the weekend. So brilliant to see that back, Greg. You know, I was talking to Sinead Breen about it last night, our county PRO. She was saying growing up, she'd love to play Camogie. Yeah. The option wasn't there. So it's another format in the GAA that, you know, we'll promote, and it's great for girls to get involved in all ages. And play the sport, and particularly if you get a chance to represent your county.
Hurlers and ladies footballers as well, there'll be talk of that. Unfortunately, we're just up against the 10 o'clock news. Let's talk about the guests. Yeah. Brendan Kilcoyne, and also he's going to be, of course, in studio. And via Zoom, Aaron Kernan from Armagh. It'll be interesting to see to hear from him. I always like to hear from the counties. You know, like, it'd be very interesting to get the Armagh perspective on where they're at and what he thinks they can do going forward. The Glasgow Gales Dinner Dance, this is down on my notes. What's that about?
Yeah, I was over there the weekend.
What was it like? Greg,
you know. Great. Just
you're looking fresh.
Thank you. I've seen the light, lad. I've toned things down a bit on the break.
That's the only reason I liked you.
There was no break dancing. But yeah, no, listen, fantastic people, brilliant weekend. So yeah, listen, it was great to go over and catch up with them, and listen, just the respect and that, and just seeing all the work that's going on in different places that the GAA is involved in. So listen, the community over there was brilliant. It was a great night.
Fantastic stuff. All right, well, look forward to the show this evening. Look after yourself, Brendan Devaney. The DL debate tonight from 7, but don't forget, if it doesn't suit you to listen then, it's available for you as a podcast very shortly afterwards.
The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. It is just after 9 o'clock on Monday, the 23rd of February, 2026. It's great to have you on board. How was your weekend? I hope it was really good. If you're into sport, it was a fantastic weekend with the rugby. We had boxing, if you're into boxing. The Olympics were finishing up. The SPL's getting very interesting. Scotland and Rangers both losing ground. What else happened? Donegal, of course, the men's seniors had a fantastic win, 4 in a row. Lots and lots of sport, it has to be said. What was your standout sporting moment of the weekend? Or let us know what you want to talk about as well. Maybe something happened to you over the weekend that you want to share. Maybe an act of kindness, maybe an issue that you think we could help you with. Anything at all. The lines are open for you right now. 086 60 25000. That's the WhatsApp and text number, 086 60 25000. We love your calls still, even in 2026. You can't beat an old conversation over the phone. 074 91 25000. Caroline Orr, our researcher and producer on the lines, assisted by ably Shannon Wilkins, and of course emails, comments at highlandradio.com. If you want to watch the programme as well, and you can chat to us there, you can go onto YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch us live on your mobile devices, or indeed your smart TV and Fire Stick, and we're across Facebook as well. So literally no excuse not to have some of the show some way or other. Let's have a quick look at what's making the papers today. And I have to say, right across the nationals, a lot of the same news. You know, I noticed a lot of the tabloids now, the red top tabloids, they're all the same paper. Not a whole pile of variation in the news. But anyway, we've picked out some stories that may be of interest to you. The Derry People, Donegal News this morning. The chair of the newly established Donegal Local Community Safety Partnership says outside agencies, community groups and local organisations all have a part to play in helping to make people's lives safer across Donegal. The Donegal LSCSP, which has replaced the old Joint Policing Committee, will hold its first proper meeting at County House Lifford on Wednesday, and chairperson Councillor Jay McMonagle said he's looking forward to finally getting a chance to discuss and address the many issues that need tackling. The Derry News, their front page focuses really on a picture, and it is asking the question, dispute over restoration of Free Derry Wall, and there's a picture of that wall present on the front of that paper as well. On to the Nationals. Interesting analysis of people's experiences whilst doing their driving test. This is in the Irish Independent. A driving instructor spent an entire lesson watching a movie on his phone while another teacher tailgated a car, flashed the vehicle's lights and gestured at another motorist, according to complaints to the Road Safety Authority. The RSA said it had been contacted by more than 160 unhappy learner drivers last year about the quality of driving lessons and instruction. Sorry, I did say testing, I meant lessons. One person accused their instructor of using a racial slur, making sexualized comments and joking about women's aid for battering his car. The complaint claimed the teacher had said, "Watch that hand or I'll have a case against you," implying that I had nearly touched him inappropriately, which I absolutely had not. Another learner wrote of receiving threatening text messages from an instructor who said they were going to report them for driving without insurance. They added, "A girl has also come out to me saying he would be talking about other girls during driving lessons, talking about private body parts with his clients. Completely unacceptable." It's a very personal space, that, in a car with a stranger. The one thing I will say, though, these surveys come out annually in relation to people getting lessons and stuff. But I've never really heard these stories from a real person or in person. So, I mean, maybe you've got a story. It doesn't have to be very serious. It can be lighthearted either. Maybe you've got a story in relation to your lessons or your test. Share it with us this Monday morning, 086 60 25,000. A lot of money gets spent on the president and its office. €570,000 is going to be spent on merchandise. I can't even get a mug here or a T-shirt to give away. But anyway, that being said, I probably haven't asked. The government is proposing to spend almost €600,000 on tote bags, stationery and other merchandise to promote Ireland's EU presidency. This is the presidency, not the president. Again, sorry, my mistake. Ireland is due to take over the rotating presidency in July and will hold it for 6 months. As part of preparations, the Department of Foreign Affairs is ordering large consignments of branded merchandise for free distribution. Most of the stationery packs will be delivered to Dublin, but many will be distributed to 99 cities around the world. For example, the department is proposing to send 100 each to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia and to Maputo, Mozambique, and 200 to the Vatican. Ireland's permanent mission in Brussels to the EU will receive €11,000, while the emphasis on Washington, D.C., or the embassy, sorry, will get 400. So these are €570,000 on EU presidency merchandise. Right, so who's buying up all the houses? It's not necessarily people from within the state, because the vast bulk of investment in property is now from abroad. This is in the Irish Daily Mail. Foreign finance made up to 70% of Irish property investment last year, a new report shows. Investment turnover totaled almost €2.5 billion last year, a similar level to the 2024. Property agent Sherry Fitzgerald's latest Irish investment market report has found the total number of transactions stood at 125, just ahead of the 119 recorded in 24. As is traditionally the case, the final 3 months of the year were the most active, with investment reaching 842 million. Shops and shopping centres attracted the largest share of turnover in 2025, making up more than a quarter, 28% of total market spend. However, the gap with other asset classes narrowed, with offices accounting for 27% of turnover. The second half of last year also witnessed renewed interest in residential properties, making up 16% of turnover, while industrial and logistic assets accounted for a further 10%. So I don't know what this actually means. Maybe this is the norm in every country, but in terms of, you know, the infrastructure, shopping centres, etc., and indeed property to some extent, the vast bulk of investment in these areas comes from abroad. So I don't know. A lot of conversation, and I don't wish to bore you, about whether or not under 16s should be banned from mobile phones. I think it is worth talking about and highlighting the various sort of marks in the story, because, as I say, this isn't necessarily about, it is of course about banning under 16s from mobile phones, but the way you do that, it's everybody has to sort of identify themselves before going on the internet. That's just the byproduct of it, because you can only prove someone's age by checking everybody's age. But what do students think? And this is what I thought was an interesting advance on this story, because it's the views of children. Half of Senior Cycle Secondary School students would support introducing a social media ban for under 16s, a new survey has found. The government recently announced plans to introduce legislation restricting access for under 16s as part of its new digital and artificial intelligence strategy. The move comes following increasing interest in social media age limits from governments in France and Spain. The poll of almost 1,800 fourth, fifth and sixth year students from online study tool StudyClix found that 50% would back moves by Ireland to follow the Australian government's example in passing legislation to prevent people under the age of 16 from accessing major social media services like Instagram, X, TikTok and Facebook. So the majority of these, if this is fourth, fifth and sixth class, would the majority of them be over 16 already? But half of the total, about 900, are in favour of the ban. So half aren't. And I think that is not quite what you might call students backing it. Personally, I don't think it is anyway. Because you're not really asking either the cohort that it affects. Some would be caught in it, but anyway. A very important story to finish, and that is how dangerous the roads were over the weekend. An awful loss of life. 7 people passed away or were killed on roads, a further 6 injured. 7 people lost their lives, while 6 people were injured in separate collisions on Irish roads at the weekend. 4 fatal collisions across the country on Saturday claimed the lives of 3 women, 3 men and a teenaged girl, while 6 others, including a child, were treated for injuries. On Saturday, a man and a woman, both aged in their 40s, lost their lives following a collision involving a van and a car at around midday in Tremore in Waterford. The occupants of the car were pronounced dead at the scene, while the occupants of the van, a man aged in his 50s and a juvenile male, were taken to University Hospital Waterford for treatment of injuries believed to be non-life-threatening. A woman in her 80s also died following a single-vehicle collision in Galway. That was at around 8:15pm on Saturday. Her body was brought to the mortuary at Portumlinca Hospital, where a post-mortem will take place. A 16-year-old girl, just 16 years of age, she was killed in a hit-and-run incident on the Slane Road near Navan. The girl, a pedestrian, was struck by a car. We also had injuries to a man in a collision last evening at Umbercombe, which wouldn't be included in these statistics. Hopefully his injuries are not life-threatening and he'll make a full and speedy recovery. But can you imagine, like, 7 in this tiny wee country of ours, 7 people killed, and the heartache that's bringing into to Irish households in the days, weeks, months and years ahead. And I'm not attributing any blame to anyone, because I don't know the circumstances of the road traffic collisions, but a lot of this is avoidable. It's within our powers. And 7 people in this tiny wee country dying in one weekend is just absolutely heartbreaking. And I speak to myself when I say things like this. Maybe we need to, again, just redouble our efforts to think about how we're driving and what the consequences can be if we take our eye off the road for a second, have the right pedal down too much or whatever it might be. We are joined on the programme now by local archaeologist John O'Rourke. Good morning, John.
Morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Right, I'll take the listeners back to 1811, because in December of that year, a Royal Navy frigate sank off the coast of County Donegal, and the mystery surrounding the final resting place of part of the wreck may now finally have been solved. Recent sand displacement caused by high winds at Ballymastocker Bay in Lough Swilly have revealed that some believe to be the remains of HMS Saldanha. Before I get your view on whether or not these are in fact the remains or the wreckage of this ship, talk to me about this Royal Naval frigate and how it may have come to perish off our coast.
So back then, Greg, the vessels that plied their trade around the coast, it was like, if you can imagine, the equivalent of articulated lorries today. There were lots of them. There were continuously small, locally owned and large ocean-going vessels in and around the coast of Inishowen. It's hard to appreciate now the level of traffic there actually was. Because of the wars that were going on in Europe at the time, the English stationed a small flotilla at Rathmullen, and they patrolled what was known to the English as the Northern Approaches. So anything really north of us on the approaches to the UK would have been interdicted by the ships based in Rathmullen. So a frigate, a large vessel, but not large on the scale of things. If you've seen the Victory, for instance, far smaller than that. The Saldanha was probably about 150 feet in length, just a little bit short of 150 feet. Still a substantial vessel with a crew of maybe 270, 275 sailors. So very, very busy location at the time. On a patrol at the start of December, the Saldanha and a smaller vessel, the Talbot, went north from Lough Swilly and encountered the start of a hurricane. And it was truly a horrendous storm. We've got lots of other reports of ships that foundered that night, and of damage being done to buildings and roofs and chimneys. It was a fairly unique storm, what the sailors would have called a true hurricane. As the Saldanha would have attempted to get to shelter, she entered Lough Swilly, and we know some of the story as to what happened. Still some mystery there.
Yeah, so, and this would be, what do you do in the case of high winds or hurricane, right? The sails, massive. So you drop the sails, or you drop some of the sails, and you try and, you know, then, of course, the ability to steer the vessel is compromised. I mean, it's the worst case scenario to be in a boat like that, isn't it, with incredibly high winds and turbulent waters. It must have been horrific to be aboard.
Absolutely horrific. So every sailor has a few things they can do in these conditions. You can go to bare poles, take down the sails, scud on front of the wind. That means you're going as slowly as possible, more or less in the same direction as the wind. You can try and veer up into the wind and actually make way at an angle into the wind and try and keep your position that way. Very few other things you can do when you're in something like a hurricane in a square-rigged vessel. So we're pretty sure from reports of other vessels that they had to scud on front of the wind. There wasn't much else they could have done. We have the logs of the Talbot, and the Talbot ended up the following morning in the area of Clew Bay, that far south. And we've got some great reports from the Talbot with regard to the conditions. We're pretty sure the Saldanha, wherever she was, had to scud on front of the wind. We're also reasonably confident. Now, we've got to be like journalists here. You know, these days, you've got to check again. You've got to find the primary source for everything. And about half of what you hear is completely wrong. And we've got to take exactly the same approach. We've got to look for the veracity, and we've got to find primary sources. We're fairly certain she entered the lock at around 10 o'clock on the night of the 4th, coming south at a rapid pace down the lock. We're confident that she hit at the Swilly Rocks. They're the rocks on the west side of the entrance to the lock. And we have some evidence of that. We have some reports of that. And again, the reports are from fairly credible sources. So that one is a confident of, but not certain of. And then we've got other debris that's been recovered over the years. Anchors that have been recovered from the area north of Dunree, between Dunree and the Swilly Rocks. The masts and sails of the Saldanha came in at Dunree the following morning. So what's a very likely thing to have happened is that when she clipped the Swilly Rocks, she lost her rudder, she lost her rudder chains, and she was demasted or partly demasted at that point. Now, that would be a normal thing to happen if a sailing vessel of that vintage had a collision. So fairly confident up to where she clipped the Swilly Rocks, but she didn't break in two at that point. One thing the English have very, very well is historical documentation and public service records. So we can pull the logs and records from Kew Gardens in London, and we know exactly what was in the hold of the Saldanha. She didn't break in two on the Swilly Rocks. There's a very characteristic signature of the point she broke into.
Now, in relation to what has been revealed with the movement of sands, it's clearly a structure of some description or other. It's too uniform. It does offer itself to be a vessel of some description or other, and then you think of what might it be or what could it be. That's not enough, of course, to confirm this is indeed the wreck of the Royal Navy frigate. But in terms of confidence, where are you at now at this point that this actually could be the final resting place of this boat, this ship?
So we approach this stage a little bit like a forensic investigator. What is telling you it's not the wreck? What is telling you it is the wreck? So the shape, as you say, that shape looks to the eye, like it's the starboard bow. And there's almost 12 metres of debris, of a structure. Now, that's about 40 feet. And the vessel itself was only 150 feet long. And we have all the original shear drawings. We have the equivalent of the build data for the Saldanha. So we know exactly how far back that section goes. So that's all quite consistent with it being part of the starboard bow. But there's other things then that are a little bit inconsistent. We, again, have got loads of records of the morning after the wreck. We know that the Saldanha was split too. She was in two separate parts with debris everywhere. The main reports we have are of the wreck being in the south of the lock. Sorry, the south of the bay. So quite far away from where this debris is shown. We don't have any records for half of the vessel ending up, or a third of the vessel ending up in the mid part of the...
But we don't know what may have happened underwater with currents either, though, at the same time as things were emptied out.
Once she sat and they began to empty her, it's unlikely something of that size moved. Now, right down at the level of the keel, there were huge heavy weights, big, big, big iron bars used for ballast and gravel used for ballast. So once she was broken to and actually sat on the beach, she was actually going to sink in situ. She was going to sink in place.
So how would, is there, you see, is this kind of like trying to prove a negative then? How would it find its way to where it's been discovered then, given everything you've just said?
Absolutely no issue with that. It is completely feasible and possible that it's there. I just don't have reports that say the following morning they actually saw it at that point.
Now, we've lots
of reports from the following morning.
We've seen, we're just seeing sort of the ends of some of the structure. What's next? If you were to excavate down to expose everything that is actually lying there within the sand, I mean, what likely would we discover?
So it's the bow, and they kept the bow reasonably light. They put a lot of the ballast and a lot of the weight would have been amidships. It's 40 feet long, which means that we're into a part of the hold that would have had stuff in it. Mm. And we absolutely know what would be at the lowest levels. So let's assume it's still all intact, and let's assume that we've figured out what we're actually seeing. We can see joints on the bit that was exposed. Those joints are called scarfs. Now, I can go back then to the original designs of the vessels, and I can tell you at exactly the height they are above the keel. So either you're looking at something that's 8 foot above the keel, or 12 foot above the keel. Apologies for using imperial measurements. Everything in the old records is imperial. We'll move away from
that. I'm not going to lie to you. It suits me.
So we know that if it's the lowest joints it can possibly be we're looking at, that there's potentially 8 feet or so from there to the keel. Above the keel, there's some very characteristic things. So that iron ballast isn't random lumps of iron. It's got a particular pattern. It's got a particular shape. It'll have Admiralty markings on it, and it will have holes in exactly the right places. So if it is excavated at some point in the future, we will be able to say definitively that's an Admiralty ship, and we also know definitively that no other vessel of that size would have broken up at that point.
We're interested in it because there's history here, there's a story here, and it's local, and the way it's been revealed is really interesting. How interested are the British in relation to this? Like, is this just another vessel that may have perished during that awful weather? Like, hundreds would have, I suppose, over centuries. Is there any particular interest in this from the British? Will they be watching on? Might they be interested in some sort of an excavation?
Oh, absolutely. So we can say without contention that we have a very mixed history, but we've got to appreciate that in the Napoleonic era, about 20% of those who fought with the English were Irish. Mm-hmm. England had a much smaller population at the time, and we were a great source of warm bodies for those folks. But separate from that, everybody's heard of the Duke of Wellington, the Pakenhams, Lord Longford. Captain Pakenham of the Saldanha was one of the Longfords from he was Irish. We know looking at the muster, we know the people who were aboard, and a lot of those people were Irish. Not just were they Irish, some of them will have volunteered for you know, it was a very, very poor country, and it was one way out of poverty, although it was a horrendous existence, but people were also pressed or impressed. That means a bunch of sailors would go down to the local pub with cudgels, knock people over the head, drag them back to the boat legally, and they were impressed into the Navy. So a lot of those people weren't volunteers. Some of them were lifted out of fishing boats. One of these vessels could pull up alongside your fishing boat, lift you out of it, your family never saw you again. So there's a huge mixture of cultures here. The English are absolutely fascinated by their military history and have absolutely no doubt that we will see interest from the UK. If you want to see what the Saldanha looked like, there's a very well-restored vessel sitting in Hartlepool Harbour. So a quick flight into Newcastle, an hour's drive south, and there's a beautifully restored vessel called the Trincomalee sitting in Hartlepool. And honestly, unless you're an expert on the individual vessels, you wouldn't be able to distinguish between that and the Saldanha.
A caller says, I heard a story that some years ago when there was a particularly low tide, the rudder of the ship was found lodged in a rock at the mouth of Loch Swilly, probably still there. I'm not sure if this... Have you heard that story before?
So I've heard exactly that story, and that's consistent with everything else we know. Okay. So I have that from the 1970s in my... lists, but unfortunately it's anecdotal. I don't have the original.
I think this might be the anecdote we're leaning on here. Is this the same ship that a load of gold was supposed to be found on?
So, Greg, you have me on video.
Yes.
But the listeners won't have. Can you see my wedding ring?
I can, yes.
Can you?
Yes. No, I can't see your wedding ring, of course.
You can't.
No, yeah.
So that's the only way I can say with confidence that there's gold on the wreck of the Saldanha.
Okay. And
so during a long dive many, many years ago...
That's where you lost.
With freezing cold hands, the ring came off. So a message to future archaeologists, if you find the ring, please return it. My wife would appreciate it.
And in terms of finding out more information, is sand too dense for any sort of ground-penetrating... technology? This would require an excavation, and what would be the next step in that regard?
So we're very, very careful to be non-invasive, and it's more than just ideism. As time goes by, technology improves, and something that will destroy an artifact today, we can do non-invasively in 20 years' time. So you'll find archaeologists being incredibly conservative. There are techniques we can use right now. So we know there's iron down there, and a magnetometer will let us see iron at that sort of depth and allow us to calculate depth and volume or mass of iron. There's ground-penetrating radar that we would use on land a lot. Now, I'm not confident that will work in that wet environment, and we know there's also a lot of iron material.
It's just the density of the sand as well, too, I'd imagine. It's complicated.
Density isn't so much. For ground-penetrating radar, I could take something that looks like a wheelbarrow outside your house, and I could map all your pipes and the electricity feeds coming in. So density is not so much a problem. It's the wet environment that gives us some issues. There's another device called a sub-bottom profiler where we put low-frequency sound waves down through the actual surface of the sand, and that's absolutely magic. But again, we need a certain depth to use that. We need the depth of water. And that particular bay, when you've got a high tide, 4 metres of tide, you'll have rolling waves coming in there.
Of course,
it's a really challenging environment to work with. So there are a range of instruments we can use.
Okay.
We have to be non-invasive.
Yeah, but so you've got patience. So in other words, I'm impatient. So like, I'm not going to get an answer anytime soon. You're just sitting there going, it could take 30 years. And I so much admire it, John. But for me, like, I was hoping, like, do we start tomorrow?
What I can tell you is that even the part of the wreck that was just still exposed is actually disintegrating.
Yeah.
So if we excavate, it's a one-go job.
Exactly.
We will destroy absolutely everything that's there, and that the opportunity to study it further in the future is gone.
Sure.
Now, the competent authority is the Monument Service, and they are going to come back down again in March, and they are the folks with resources and top-end skills that will allow them to investigate further without destroying the wreck. We can work locally with our own resources, privately, but honestly, we are constrained. Like thousands of other people in Donegal, I have defective blocks. And at my age, I'm facing either with things get sorted or I'm homeless, which is something that I never expected in my 60s. So unfortunately, putting large resources into into this is beyond me at this stage.
Well, listen, I wish you the very best in navigating that process. It is not easy. Local archaeologist John O'Rourke, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Greg.
Joined on the programme now by Jason Quinn. Jason, thanks for chatting to me this morning.
Okay, yeah.
Right, now, you're refusing dialysis treatment at Letterkenny University Hospital. Why?
I've been on dialysis for about 2 years now. Mm. And the way they do dialysis is through a tube in my chest, a permanent tube in my chest. Now, that's susceptible to infection and problems. And especially last year, I had a lot of problems with the tube and gone into a kind of shock where I'd go into involuntary shakes, difficulty with breathing and low blood pressure. This is while on dialysis. And this is problems with the tube. And one of the things that can help with this is to have what's called a fistula, which means tying of an artery and a vein like in the arm, where they would put needles directly into the arm and do the dialysis that way, and you're not you're not susceptible to infection as much, and it gives you a better dialysis. I've been on the waiting list for over a year, and I'm. Middle of last year, I was told I was about seventh on the waiting list. But unfortunately, I had an infection in my leg and my foot. And I had to have my small toe and part of my foot removed because of it. So that slowed my time on the waiting list. Last October, I was told I was going back on the list again because the injury on the other that was left by the wound was clean and infection free. Just before December, I rang up Galway trying to find out what was happening, and I was informed that the consultant down there only does one of these procedures once a month.
So just for the uninitiated, Jason, you are refusing dialysis treatment through your chest. You want it to be delivered through an arm. Is that correct? Just in the most simple terms.
Yes.
And when you say you're waiting, are you waiting to be seen by a consultant who can refer you for that type of treatment, or are you waiting to begin that treatment and you were seventh on the list? So what are you actually waiting on?
I've had all the referrals done. This was done last February last year, and I've been waiting on the list for over a year. Mm. But I was actually told last week by the manager in the renal unit at Letterkenny that the consultant in Galway only meets with his team about these procedures once a month on the first Monday of each month. Mm-hmm. Now, in January, it wasn't going to happen. February was a bank holiday. I don't know what's happening about March. But April, May, June are all bank holidays, and they're not going to be meeting. Okay. So I've been told the first time they're going to be meeting is in July.
And is this with a view to getting something inserted in your arm that receives the dialysis then? I just want to really make sure I understand what you're waiting on.
What it is they link up an artery and a vein.
Okay.
Like in my arm. Uh-huh. And then when that heals, they can put needles directly into my arm to do the dialysis rather than taking the feed from the tube.
And when that is done, you can get your dialysis treatment to Letterkenny University Hospital.
Well, I get it done there anyway, but it makes the dialysis easier.
Understood. Yeah.
And less of risks of things going wrong.
Yeah, I just want to get... So, in other words, you're waiting to see a consultant to get this operation, to have this line put into your arm, so then you can continue receiving dialysis in Letterkenny University Hospital in that way, as opposed to through your chest, because the that way is your preference, right? So, what is the impact on you refusing dialysis treatment in the way that you don't want it delivered to you? What's the impact on your body and your health? Because you've already got an infection to the point where you've had to have part of your foot amputated.
If I refusing dialysis means fluid just builds up in my body, and it just stores it and stores it until your body just will slow down, and it'll impact other parts like your breathing and your mobility and stuff. But the thing is, I'm waiting and waiting. Galway will not give you a clear, definitive answer of what's happening. You're getting pushed aside all the time. Mm. I'm not getting any answers. So what I'm looking from Galway is, I want a specific date of when this is happening, not just being pushed along with no information.
Is your resistance to dialysis now something then of a protest? Because, whilst I understand that you don't want to do it through the chest, there's a fear of infection, but you also, there is a point where, as a medical professional, you have to balance potentially the long-term impacts on your health in not doing so. So you're prepared to risk your body deteriorating to avoid infection from getting dialysis through your chest. Does that make sense medically?
It does make sense to other people, but for me, the whole situation, I've encountered many problems in the renal unit through the consultants at Letterkenny Hospital, and it's impacted on my mental health.
I do understand.
The fact that last year I had to go on antidepressants, mm-hmm. which actually made me even worse. I was collapsing after dialysis and injuring myself.
Yes.
And I've got to the point where I have no quality of life.
And I'm really, really sorry to hear that. But are there competing issues here for you, Jason, in that you've made a mental decision not to continue with dialysis, really, and not a physical decision, if that makes sense, that you've associated negativity and negative thoughts and the fear of infection to the point whereby it's detrimental to you, that you are almost saying, right, well, the only solution to all of this is to see this consultant and go away and to get my dialysis a different way. Would you not be better to, as best you can, look after your physical health now until such time this intervention takes place? Because I understand, and I'm incredibly sympathetic, Jason, but dialysis is a life-saving treatment, and to refuse that over the risk of infection, albeit that you've got, an awful lot of emotional connection to it as well, it might not be in your best interest. That's all I'm suggesting, if you don't mind me saying so, Jason.
No, that's understandable. And but what I, by not going in, I is my only way of making a point, because you say to people and you try and speak to the consultants and try and put your point across, they just don't listen.
Yeah,
then there's been several times when things go wrong when they haven't listened, and my quality of life is deteriorating.
I hope
nowhere else to go.
I understand that, and trust me, I'm so sympathetic to you. But I just hope that you aren't doing yourself damage in the process, because ethically, really, from a doctor's perspective, they would have to bump someone down to bump you up, and I'm not sure they'll do that. And I just hope that the protest, if you can put it to you like that, that you're taking is actually the only person that this is impacting is yourself, Jason. And you've been through enough, and you're going through enough. And I just hope that you're not doing, you're not doing yourself a disservice. Whilst I fully get that you feel like you're at the end of your tether in this process,
it's not a case of wanting to jump the queue. I was told last year I was seventh in the waiting list, and now, although things went a bit pear-shaped last year. I still have not been given any specifics about what's happening. There's no actual, this is happening here, this is happening there. I rung up Galway last Thursday, mm-hmm. and told them the situation, and the person on the phone said, thank you very much, and hung the phone up on me, mm. and that was it. They just don't want to listen. They don't want to tell you any details.
Well, what we can
and
do...
Jason,
what we can do is try and inquire as to the future appointments and what the situation is there. I don't understand why appointments don't take place because it's a bank holiday. Surely they'd be rescheduled to Tuesday. I mean, if you schedule appointments or meetings on Mondays, you're going to miss them automatically. It's a strange bit of scheduling, so we'll have to check into that. But as I say, Jason, I do fully sympathise with you. I do understand exactly where you're coming from. But I also think that you can continue this battle, but also get your treatment. You don't want anything else to have to be cut off, you know. But listen, you're your own man and you have to make your own decisions. But leave it with us and we'll be in touch with you off air, okay?
Yeah, and can I just say one more thing, Greg, please? Yeah, I just want to say about the nurses in the renal unit at Letterkenny. The nurses in that unit are 100%, and they're an absolutely fantastic crowd. And I just want to mention that the excellent work that they do in there.
And they wouldn't do anything purposely to harm you, and maybe you can trust that relationship.
No. They try and talk me out of doing stuff like this.
My advice to you is, Jason, as someone who's sort of dealt with a lot of this stuff, various campaigns, people trying to get, is that you can achieve this and get your treatment. Not taking your treatment is probably not going to advance your cause in any way, shape or form. And I say that with love, it's probably not going to happen. So if I were you, I would keep the battle up. We can make our inquiries. I would go and get your treatment and give you and try and get some solace in that, Jason, and some strength actually for the battle by trying to control what you're going through. And as I say, I mean that with love and respect, Jason. But leave it with us. We'll be back in touch with you if we find anything out. The DL Debate is on air for you tonight, just after 7 p.m. and available for you whenever you wish via the podcast system. Let us say good morning to its presenter, Brendan Devenny. Hi, Brendan. Good to see you.
Good to see you, lad.
Right, OK. Busy, busy weekend in the world of sport, not least on the GEA pitches. We'll start with the senior men's because that was the game that was on yesterday. 4 out of 4, weathered storm, showed resilience, plenty of talent in that squad. Might end up winning the first division even if they don't want to.
Yeah. Listen, Greg, if we were in any other province, you would say just go for it at this point. Not to say that we won't yet. Yeah. Who are we to judge them? Listen, momentum is a big thing. How do you marry that with Ulster Championship is the problem in terms of tough games and that. And you think, okay, go and win it. Go and win Ulster. Then you're in obviously the All-Ireland series and then the big crunch knockout game. So it's a matter just of managing the season and keeping everybody fresh. But at the minute, I mean, after the McKenna Cup, the brilliance will be seen there. You know, it's top class. I mean, Jason McGee, the form he's in returning, and, you know, 4 points from him and Lang and 8 points from midfield. You know, these guys are big, talented ball winners, but they're serious lads to finish as well. And Owen Bahan being back too, fit, Greg, you know, not a lot of people talking about him, but his... And the new rules, the way he breaks forward, he's such a brilliant ball carrier that before he would have ran into, you know, a bit of a blanket defence at the other side. Now he's running into massive gaps. So he's so good on the ball coming out from defence. So he's another key man in there, back fit along with Jason, which has been a huge difference to us this year.
Options are fantastic if you're a manager. Now you create those options yourself, don't you? But there's a lot of different ways that this team can play.
Yeah, and that's, I think just if you look at it on the ball, you know, we are so good. There's so many people breaking the lines coming up the pitch. Like, literally everybody is contributing. Like, McCall tends to be the only person who really stands and minds the house. Everybody else is breaking up the pitch and everybody's scoring. So in terms of an opposition defence trying to hold that, that's nearly impossible. It is impossible. And when you look then, as I say, with the aerial ability out there, you know, I think previous years, you know, if... Like I said, Jason was in there and Langan, maybe Hugh wouldn't play. Now Jim prefers to play as many big men out there, because that midfield battle is key. If we won that, if we get even a 50-50 of that, we're going to we have too many line breakers, too many people could pop the ball over the bar in the back of the net. As Conor O'Donnell did, backing up his goal the previous week against Mayo, which was vital score.
Yeah, what are you looking across the other games that took place over the weekend? I mean, you can't watch them all, right? But I mean, any stories pop out for you sort of outside of Ulster?
Yeah, well, everybody else's movie, there seems to be not hitting form. He's obviously Armagh are in the relegation battle. Dublin are playing poorly. You know, everything again for us is probably pointing towards Kerry. You know, Roscommon's story has been remarkable. They should have beaten Kerry in opening day, and they should have been sitting on 8 with us. So, you know, when Marco Dow got that job, local guy, he'd been involved in a couple of teams before. A lot of people were thinking, you know, they've just put him in to guide the team a bit. But he had other ideas, and I'm hearing good stuff about him. So they've been phenomenal. 11 points down to Galway, coming back and beating their rivals there. So there's been some great stories in there. Kieran McDonald's son coming on from Mayo, kicking a couple of unbelievable scores. Of course, they're losing him.
1-4 he scored, did he?
Yeah, they're losing him.
Not a bad return.
Aussie Rules, which is tough on Mayo. You really think of all things they could do with a star like that.
This time of the season, I don't even want to talk about Mayo. I don't mean that badly, but there's been so many full stones with them. But yeah, hey, maybe this will be the year.
Every year. It's nearly every year, isn't it?
Yeah. Camogie.
Yeah, listen, Ewan Nadal's joined us tonight, Camogie manager. Listen, there's been a massive break in County Camogie here in Donegal, but they've got a team together. They come in the competition, kind of got the green light to come in fairly late. They played Monaghan the weekend. So brilliant to see that back, Greg. You know, I was talking to Sinead Breen about it last night, our county PRO. She was saying growing up, she'd love to play Camogie. Yeah. The option wasn't there. So it's another format in the GAA that, you know, we'll promote, and it's great for girls to get involved in all ages. And play the sport, and particularly if you get a chance to represent your county.
Hurlers and ladies footballers as well, there'll be talk of that. Unfortunately, we're just up against the 10 o'clock news. Let's talk about the guests. Yeah. Brendan Kilcoyne, and also he's going to be, of course, in studio. And via Zoom, Aaron Kernan from Armagh. It'll be interesting to see to hear from him. I always like to hear from the counties. You know, like, it'd be very interesting to get the Armagh perspective on where they're at and what he thinks they can do going forward. The Glasgow Gaels dinner dance, this is down on my notes. What's that about?
Yeah, I was over there the weekend.
What was it like? Greg,
you know. Oh, great, great. Just
you're looking fresh.
Thank you. I've seen the light, lad. I've toned things down a bit on the break.
That's the only reason I liked you.
There was no break dancing. But yeah, no, listen, fantastic people, brilliant weekend. So yeah, listen, it was great to go over and catch up with them. And listen, just the respect and just seeing all the work that's going on in different places that the GAA is involved in. So listen, the community over there was brilliant. It was a great night.
Fantastic stuff. All right, well, look forward to the show this evening. Look after yourself, Brendan Devaney. The DL debate tonight from 7, but don't forget, if it doesn't suit you to listen then, it's available for you as a podcast very shortly afterwards.